We take you now to Charlotte.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. One of the biggest crowds ever to assemble in the South has gathered in Charlotte, North Carolina this afternoon to pay tribute to the President of the United States. The National Broadcasting Company will bring you the address of the President as he speaks to the throng of admirers assembled in and near the new American Legion Memorial Stadium in Charlotte. We've just received the report that the President will be here in just a few moments. He's motoring, as you know, east into Charlotte from Asheville, and he's been on the way most of the day, stopping, of course, making short addresses from his automobile to the crowds which have gathered along the route to wave and wish him well. All day long, trains, buses, and automobiles have been bringing Southerners into Charlotte. They've come from Alabama, Florida, Georgia, North and South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia to swell the throng of the Green Pastures Rally. The President left Washington Tuesday night, traveling overnight to Knoxville. And yesterday he motored through the Great Smoky Mountains, realizing a desire of 30 years standing. He and his party spent the night at Asheville, and as we've told you today, the motor caravan, headed by the chief executive, has continued on toward Charlotte and is due here in just a short time. The Green Pastures Rally Reception Committee will meet the President downtown in Charlotte and bring him, escorted through the flag-draped streets lined with those crowds which we saw just a short time ago, to the special speaker's platform erected in the American Legion Memorial Stadium. As the President has come along his route from Asheville, Kings Mountain, Shelby, Gastonia, telephone calls have come in reporting his route. And while he was due here something like a half an hour ago, we do expect that he'll be here in this tremendous gathering of people in the Memorial Stadium is waiting patiently. They've been listening to the bands of the high school and of the 17th Field Artillery from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And now a number by the Fort Bragg Band under the direction of its bandmaster, Warrant Officer Hendrick Scholtens, the Fort Bragg Band. Now while the music goes on, the crowd starts cheering. They're standing up in their steps. They've been peeking over the edges here and have gotten a glimpse of the President's car as it passes along one end of the stadium in front of the National Guard Armory. Now the motorcycle escort is hailed into sight and the crowd lets go with a cheer of welcome for the President of the United States. We thought from our point of vantage here on the speaker's platform, right alongside the President's microphone, that we'd be able to see the President's car when it came into sight. But apparently it's merely the motorcycle men that have caused the cheering here in anticipation of the President's arrival, and actually he may be coming along Trade Street in Charlotte and making his way here with his motor caravan. The announcements go on now to the crowd all afternoon. Mr. Walter Cartier, the superintendent of Parks and Recreation for Charlotte, has been doing yeoman duty here on this public address microphone, keeping the crowd amused and happy with music, announcements of the President's coming, and general announcements of interest to them. The word's just been passed over to us that the President has arrived at the railroad station in downtown Charlotte. That's merely a landmark in this instance because he's come by automobile and not by rail. However, following this Green Pastures rally, the President will return to the station and there board his special train, which will take him back to Washington, arriving there tomorrow morning. Mr. Haywood Robbins, general chairman of the Green Pastures rally, will open the program formally and present the mayor of Charlotte, the Honorable Ben E. Douglas, who in turn will introduce the governor of North Carolina, the Honorable J.C.B. Eringhouse. And Governor Eringhouse will present the president both to the radio audience and to the tremendous gathering of people here in the American Legion Memorial Stadium. This stadium, incidentally, is a WPA project and has just been finished. This is the first time that it's ever been used. It will be formally dedicated on September 26th when the University of North Carolina meets Wakefield, Wake Forest, in a football game here on this athletic field. The crowds are standing all along the outside of the stadium, the overflow crowds over in the Central High School athletic field. And our estimate of the crowd, which has turned out here in Charlotte to hear the President, would be around 50,000. And of course, there are many more lining the streets of Charlotte to get a glimpse of the President as he motors along in his open car from downtown Charlotte to the stadium. It's been trying to shower here for some hour. Thus far has only been partially successful, but it has sprinkled a little a few times, enough to scare some of the people. And they've gone back in under the trees and raised their umbrellas, but now the sky has broken and it looks like it's not going to rain. The front part of the speaker's platform, a very small area, is covered, and we're standing under that covered area with our microphones. And quite a number of the notables which fill the rest of the stand have been also standing up under the covered part in order that they'll not get wet with the few drops of water that have been falling. There's the announcement on the public address system that the program will be in charge of Mr. Haywood Robbins, general chairman of the Green Pastures rally. The crowd is still awaiting the arrival of the President, and we're going to see if we can't get another musical number out of this Central High School Band of Charlotte. Yes, the leader, Mr. L.R. Sides, is poised, and there's the music. Thank you. And perhaps we'd better explain that cheer. Once again, this crowd which is waiting for the president has been misled. That was an official car and a very official looking car. But the fact remains that it was filled with Secret Service men who have just come over the route the president will follow. The car did not contain the president of the United States. Now it started raining again, and the people are running for cover and raising their umbrellas, putting their raincoats on. But that's not going to dampen the enthusiasm of the greeting which the president is going to get, a sample of which you've been able to hear in the background each time this crowd thinks the president is coming. Colonel Starling, chief of the White House detail of the Secret Service, has just come up on the platform, so we know definitely that it's only going to be just a little while before the president arrives on the scene. There are quite a number of state officials and United States officials here on the platform who've come to pay their tribute to the president today. We've seen Senator William L. Hill of Florida and the Honorable O. Max Gardner, former governor of North Carolina. Congressman Robert L. Doughton, chairman of the House Committee on Ways and Means and representative of the 9th District of North Carolina, is here with Mrs. Doughton. The Honorable Cameron Morrison, former United States Senator from North Carolina and former governor of the state, is among those present on the platform. The Honorable James Burns, United States Senator from South Carolina, is here. We haven't as yet seen either of the United States Senators from North Carolina, but we understand that they are both arrived with the president. Senator Robert R. Reynolds and Senator Josiah W. Bailey. Also coming along with the president is the governor of North Carolina, the Honorable J.C.B. Eringhouse, who has been motoring with the president from Asheville. And now it's raining quite hard, and fortunately for us, our microphones are in under the canopy which has been erected for the president. So we think that we'll be able to keep dry, and also that the president will be able to keep dry, and the program will go on without question. There's the announcement that the president's party has just passed the post office, which means that they have come approximately a quarter of a mile from the station, our last report, and it should be a very short time until he arrives here at the platform. Governor Hill McAllister of Tennessee is traveling with the president. He greeted him yesterday at Knoxville and rode with the president through part of his tour through the Great Smoky Mountains. Governor Olin D. Johnson of South Carolina is here, and a good many of his South Carolina citizens swell the crowd which has come here to make up this great seven-state Green Pastures rally to greet the President of the United States. The governor was called on a little while ago and addressed the throng informally and received a great hand. Now Colonel Starling has come up to the front of the stand, and he's inspecting the arrangements which have been made for the president. Colonel, how far behind? And the colonel says that it will be probably 5 or 10 minutes. So he's laughing at us. He's seen us in this situation before, when it's a little difficult sometimes to run the president of the United States on a tour of this kind exactly on schedule. And we're all getting along as best we can, and the colonel has just given us the old quack, quack with his fingers and a laugh, because he knows that until the president comes, we're going to keep this program going on and be ready for his address. Again, the informal, disorganized cheering of the crowd, and now the president of the United States has come into sight of part of this crowd, and you hear the result. There's quite a troop of state highway patrolmen on their motorcycles escorting him along as he comes by one end of the National Guard armory and will take the road into the back end of the stadium, and then will make his way to the front of the platform. One gentleman that's been receiving quite a bit of attention from this crowd this afternoon is the Democratic nominee for governor of North Carolina, the Honorable Clyde R. Hoey. He's here on the platform to participate in the reception for the president. Senator Scott M. Lofton of Florida is here, and Senator Kenneth McKellar of Tennessee. Riding in an open car with the rain beating down on him. He's certainly getting wet, but he's waving to this crowd and receiving the tremendous ovation which goes up as his automobile came into sight. The crowd's getting wet, but along with them, the President of the United States. Let's listen for a moment to the ovation which the President receives. You've heard the greeting that's gone up, and now the Central High School Band of Charlotte playing Hail to the Chief. While the band plays Hail to the Chief, we've noticed at the far end of the stadium, coming down from the sky, a very, very beautiful rainbow. The sun is shining and it's raining. The President of the United States is wet, and so is everyone of this tremendous throng of thousands who have come here today to the American Legion Memorial Stadium in Charlotte, to the Green Pastures Rally, to hear an address by the President of the United States. He's hidden from view for just a moment at the rear of the speaker's platform, but we believe now that he's getting out of his automobile, and the other members of the official party are coming up on the platform down the center aisle and taking the seats which have been reserved for them here. And now, once more, the President comes into view of the Green Pastures Rally. United States Senator Scott M. Lofton, who has been a member of the presidential party through the city of Charlotte, has come along the platform. With the president riding in the open car in the rain was his youngest son, John, who's been traveling with him quite a bit of late. John was with the president on his recent 11-day tour through the drought states of the Great Plains and Middle West, when the president conferred with the governors of some 20 states on drought conditions in their states. And now, gentlemen, we mentioned a few moments ago, Senator James Burns of South Carolina, very popular with his audience here today, walking down the center aisle with the Honorable Josiah W. Bailey, United States Senator from North Carolina. The sun shines and we still have a rainbow. And there's the greeting of this crowd for the President of the United States in Charlotte, North Carolina. United States Senator Robert R. Reynolds of North Carolina, coming down the center aisle of the speaker's platform here, shaking hands. He seems to know everyone on the platform, and of course it's quite natural that he would. And now the president, his son John, Governor J.C.B. Ehringhouse of North Carolina, are slowly making their way down the platform to the front for the chairs which have been placed for them here. As soon as the president takes his chair, you will hear Mr. H. Haywood Robbins, 26-year-old Charlotte attorney, general chairman of the Green Pastures Rally, who will formally open this meeting. The president is standing in front of the crowd now, waving to them. He's taken off his hat, and he's waving that also. The next voice you hear will be that of Mr. H. Haywood Robbins, general chairman of the Green Pastures Rally. Another wave and a Roosevelt smile, and again the cheers of the crowd.
Quiet, please.
Mr. Robin.
Dr. Luther Little, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Charlotte, North Carolina, will deliver the invocation. Dr. Little.
Thou great God of the universe, and the Father of us all, we thank thee for what thou art, the psalm of praise that's in our hearts has been made real by the presence of our friends in this great occasion. Thou hast brought songs of joy to our hearts by the fellowship and smiles of these our friends from the many states here gathered. We are grateful to thee for our country, its government, its ideals, and its institutions. We hallow thy name for the great and the good men and women who have led us triumphantly thus far. We are grateful to thee for the citizens in all the walks of life. We're so happy for the certain and ever brightening skies in our country, in our country, in our country. We thank thee for his good heart, his broad sympathy for suffering humanity, and his tireless toil in our behalf. May thy unfailing wisdom still be with him. Keep his body, mind, and soul safe, sheltered in thy love. For the entire nation we pray. And may the blessings of our God be upon the people here and everywhere. And this prayer we make in our Savior's name. Amen.
Mr. President, Governor Erringhouse, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, as your presiding officer, I am very happy to welcome the host of distinguished guests and the multitude of citizenship from the southeastern states assembled here on this historic occasion. It now gives me great pleasure to present His Honor, the Mayor of the City of Charlotte, the Honorable Ben E. Douglas, who will state the purpose of his appearance. Mayor Douglas.
Mr. President,
distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, as mayor, I am happy to welcome you to the Queen City of the South. We are delighted to do honor to the great leader who is our guest today. It is my hope that the visitors will find in Charlotte a city of good neighbors. And now, ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce and present to you North Carolina's foremost citizen, His Excellency, the Honorable J.C.B. Eringhouse, Governor of the State of North Carolina. Governor Eringhouse.
Mr. President, fellow citizens, voicing, as I know I do, the unbounded admiration and affection, I am happy to present to a grateful and a gracious people the Gideon of democracy, who worthily wears its shield and buckler, and who valiantly wields the shining sword of its consecrated service. Our leader, our captain courageous, our present, and our next president.
Governor Eringhouse, Mr. Mayor, my friends of Charlotte, I notice that the rainbow shines in the sky. And it is a fitting climax to two of the most delightful days that I've ever spent in my life. I am grateful, Governor Eringhouse, for your hospitality. And may I, through you, thank the people of the old North State for the welcome that they have given me. I am told that this meeting is a green pastures meeting. And the showers that we've passed through today prove that the pastures of North Carolina are green. What a memory those words call forth. In all of our schooling, in every part of the land, no matter to what church we happen to belong, the old 23rd Psalm is in all probability better known to the men, women, and children than any other poem in the English language. And in this great lyric, what do we best remember? Two lines. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. And it does not greatly matter whether that symbol of an ideal of human, physical, and spiritual happiness was written in its original 3,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 years ago. It might have been written just as well in the 20th century of the Christian era. Have you ever stopped to think that happiness is most often described in terms of the simple ways of nature rather than in the complex ways of man's fabrication. Perhaps that is because peace is necessary to ultimate happiness. And perhaps, therefore, when we seek a symbol of happiness, we do not go to the rush of crowded city streets or to the hum of machinery to find our goal. The ancient psalmist did not use the parable of the merchant's camel train or the royal palace or the crowded bazaar of the East. He had, in his day as we have today, the problems of competing trade and social crowding. And I venture to suggest that long before the Christian era, the ancient civilizations of the East were confronted with problems of social economics, which, though small in point of numbers compared with us, and small in point of worldly goods compared with us, were still, by comparison, as potent in their effect and as difficult in their solution as the extraordinarily similar problems of social economics that face us in this country today. And be it remembered that those ancient kings and prophets reverted, just as we do today, to the good earth and the still waters when they idealized security of the body and mind. A recent writer has suggested that the present President of the United States, because perhaps of where he was born and where he was trained, and because perhaps of his natural proclivity, he inevitably reverts to terms of land and water in his approach to any great problem. I fear that I must plead guilty to that charge, though I do so with the reservation that this is in spite of the fact that during the greater part of my life I have been in far closer contact with the more exciting and more highly competitive give and take of the profession of the law, of the practice of business, and of the exactions of public service. Green pastures. Millions of our fellow Americans, with whom I have been associating in the past 2 weeks out on the great plains of America, they live with prayers and hopes for the fulfillment of what those words imply. Still waters. Millions of other Americans, with whom I also have been associated of late, are living with prayers and hopes either that the floods may be stilled, floods that bring with them destruction and disaster to fields and flocks and homesteads and cities, or else they look for the heaven-sent rains that will fill their wells, their ponds, and their peaceful streams. Many years ago, I talked with a learned man about this continent, about what North America was like when the white man came. I asked him if the great plains that extend hundreds and hundreds of miles from the Mississippi to the Rockies were always bare of trees, always the pasturage of buffalo and antelope. And he said yes, for many hundreds of years, without doubt. But it is my belief that trees could have grown and can still be grown on those plains, but that they have been prevented from growing by the constant succession of prairie fires set either by the lightning or the red man. And then I asked him about the streams of the Southland. were they always brown and full of silk before our white ancestors moved in? No, he said, in those earlier days, during the greater part of the year, the southern rivers were clear streams, except perhaps for a week or so in the springtime when they had moderate freshets, small floods. And when they occurred, some soil, a very little soil, was washed from the uplands of the south, washed from the mountains of the south, down into the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf. But because these floods were seasonal only in their effect and small in volume, the natural accretion of new topsoil took the place of that which had run off into the sea. If history gives a name to this day and age that we're living in, I hope it will call it the era of rebuilding. For it is my firm conviction that unless we in our generation start to rebuild, the Americans of a century hence will have lost the greater part of their natural and national heritage. And my friends, it is because I have spent these latter years so much in this Southland, and because I have come to know its fine people, its brave history, and its many problems, that I speak not as a stranger to you who are gathered here from seven states. I have seen the denuding of your forests. I have seen the washing away of your topsoil. I have slid into the ditch from your red clay highways. And I have taken part in your splendid efforts to save your forests, to terrace your land, to harness your streams, and to push hard surface roads into every county in every state. And I've been even braver than that. I have even assumed the amazing role of a columnist for a Georgia newspaper in order that I might write powerful pieces against burning over the farm woodlot and in favor of the cow, hog, and hen program. So may I add that it is because of practical experience on my own farm that for many years before I was inaugurated president, I came to the conclusion that cotton, as it stood then, was essentially a speculative crop, and that the planter of cotton, because he had nothing to say about the price he would receive, could never tell when he put the seed in the ground whether he would make a big profit by selling his crop for 25 cents a pound or go broke by selling his crop for 5 cents a pound. It is perhaps a bit of history hitherto unrecorded that in the month of March 1933, I said this to the Secretary of Agriculture, Mr. Wallace. I said in respect to cotton, and I talked to him about lots of crops, in respect to cotton, I have a definite objective. The cotton farmer has been cursed for a generation by the fact of insecurity. The price for his crop has run up the scale and down the scale, and up the scale and down the scale again. In recent years, mind you, I was speaking in 1933, in recent years, its total aggregate production has been so great that 13 million bales overhang the market. He will starve on 5 cent cotton. The South will starve on 5 cent cotton. And just as long as this appalling carryover hangs over the market, he will never get a price that will even bring him out whole. My objective, Mr. Secretary, is to control and reduce that unwieldy surplus, to get for the cotton planter 10 cent cotton the first year that we're in office, and 12 cent cotton or more for the next 3 years. You and I must keep that goal before us. And my friends, I ask you in simple fairness, have we attained that goal? You know the story of cotton. You know the story of tobacco, too. There again, your national government had a goal. I don't believe that the great tobacco-growing states of the nation would wish to go back to the days of every man for himself and let the devil take the hindmost. Again, long before I went to Washington, I was convinced that the long road that leads to green pastures and still waters had to begin with reasonable prosperity. It seemed axiomatic to me that a cotton farmer who could get only 5 cents a pound for his crop could not be in a position properly to fertilize his land, or to terrace it, or to plant a little orchard, or to cultivate a garden. In other words, to work out for himself and his family a well-rounded, reasonably secure life that would tide him and them over a lean year of drought. And the same thing held true, I thought, in the case of the farmer whose principal crop was tobacco, or whose principal crop was peaches, or whose principal crop was corn, or wheat, or cattle, or hogs. In other words, we could not go ahead to the next step of prevention of soil erosion throughout the South and indeed throughout the nation. We could not go ahead to the transfer of thin pastures into forests and the transfer of submarginal plowed land into pastures and trees. We could not go ahead to the use of many modern methods to stop soil erosion and to prevent floods until and unless the farmers of the Southland were able to make a reasonably decent living out of their farm. And what's the answer? Today, because of better prices for farm commodities, we are actually and actively engaged in taking these second steps. Not only have we aroused a public understanding, a public approval of the need of ending soil erosion and water runoff, but we have enabled the public, through a practical prosperity, to begin to pay their debts, to paint their homes, to buy farm tools and automobiles, to send more boys and girls through school and college, to put some money in the bank, and incidentally, to know for the first time that the money in the bank is safe. So much for the green pastures and the still waters in their more literal physical terms. Those ancient words apply, however, with equal force to men and women and children. Your life and mine, though we work in the mill, or in the office, or in the store, can still be a life in green pastures and beside still waters. No man, no woman, no family can hope in any part of the country to attain security in a city on starvation wages. Any more than they can hope on a farm to attain security on starvation crop prices. I do not have to tell you who live in any of these southern states which have factories in all of them that a family that tries to subsist on a total wage income of $300 or $400 a year is just as much a drag on the prosperity of America as the farm family that seeks to subsist on a yearly cash income of $100 or $200 a year. And that is why a good many thinking people in and out of finance and business and every other walk of life believe that the National Recovery Act, during its short term of life, accomplished as much for the restoration of prosperity through the establishment of the minimum wage, the shortening of hours, and the elimination of child labor as any law put on the statute books of the federal government in the past century and a half. In the summer of 1934, the head of one of the great mail order houses said to me, "Do you remember my telling you a year ago that the purchasing power of the South had dropped to almost zero? Look at this report of our sales in all the southern states. All of our sales have increased, but those in the South have come back faster than any. And the reason is that the South at last has begun to acquire purchasing power." And finally, in this fourth year of definite upturn, you and I have come to appreciate another significant and inevitable result. You and I live under three kinds of government. And to all three, we as citizens pay taxes. Our local estate taxes, mainly on real estate, go to the support of local or state functions of government, such as schools and highways, city and county administrations, water supply, sewer systems, street lighting, peace officers, and state institutions. And our federal taxes, none of which, by the way, are on real estate, come in the form of tobacco and similar excises, and income, inheritance, corporation taxes, and are spent in the running of the federal government for national defense, for pensions, for forests, for parks, for highways, for public works of all kinds, and for relief of the unemployed. 4 years ago, all of us in every part of the United States found that without any change in the local or the state tax schedules, the tax receipts had fallen off to an alarming degree. The result was that counties and cities and states were failing to balance their budgets or else were unable to carry out the ordinary and orderly functions and obligations of state and local government. Schools were being closed or their year curtailed. Teachers were unpaid. Roads lacked repairs. The borrowing of money for permanent improvements had become impossible. With the federal government, despite additional new forms of taxes in those days, the receipts of revenue in 1932 had been cut in half. The value of those tangible assets, private assets, on which taxes were based, had fallen so low that even if the income had been there to pay the taxes with, the sums received would have put all forms of government increasingly in the red. And even when some remnant of value remained on which to levy a tax, the taxpayer did not have the wherewithal to make the payment and was beginning to lose the very property that was taxed. That is why I go back to the original thesis that any common sense, logical government policy had to begin with the building up of farm and other property values, crop values, and the increase of workers' wages, if that now historic corner was ever to be turned. History records that only a few years ago, farmers were not making both ends meet. Workers in factories were not making both ends meet. The small businessman was not making both ends meet. And the corporation was not making both ends meet. As a logical result, local governments were not making both ends meet. And neither were the state governments. And neither was the national government. And incidentally, as another result in those days, the individual that had to borrow, the corporation that had to borrow, and the government that had to borrow, all of them were compelled to pay unconscionable and ruinous interest rates. History will also record that by the year 1936, a very much larger number of individuals are back in the black. And so are most of our small businessmen. And so are most of our corporations. And so are almost all of our municipal and county and state governments. History will also record that individuals and corporations and governments are paying today a far more reasonable rate of interest than at any previous time in the history of the American Republic. In the process of attaining these successful ends, my friends, individual liberties have not been removed. And I believe that the governor of North Carolina and almost every other governor in all these 48 states will agree also that the rights of the sovereign states have not been invaded. It was obvious, of course, because of the economic unity of the entire nation in these modern days, that no group of individuals and no individual states acting all alone could by themselves take the action necessary to restore the purchasing power of the United States as a whole. only the federal government could ask and receive the cooperation of all the states in heading up a nationwide plan based on the sound concept of restoring purchasing power and prosperity to the great mass of our citizens. And so I speak to you today. I speak to you today as common sense American men and women. You will agree that from the material aspect, this nation's consuming power has been and is being rapidly restored. And I trust, therefore, that you will agree to the other proposition that better conditions on the farm, better conditions in the factory, better conditions in the homes of America are leading us to that beautiful spiritual figure of the old psalmist, green pastures and still water.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States addressing the Seven State Green Pastures Rally in the Memorial Amphitheater at Charlotte, North Carolina. This program has reached you through the National Broadcasting Company.